Good morning and welcome to a special broadcast of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald J. Trump. I'm Mitch Jezrich in the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. In just a moment, Supreme Court Justice John Roberts will bring the trial to order for the third and final day of the House Democratic floor manager's oral arguments. Today, we anticipate the floor managers to make the case for the second article of impeachment, which is obstruction of Congress. President Trump's defense team is scheduled to begin their arguments tomorrow. Next week will be a critical moment in this trial, as senators will have 16 hours for questions in which the floor managers and the defense team may be able to actually rebut one another. And then the votes as to whether to have witnesses and to allow for the admission of additional evidence into the trial. As we wait for the trial to begin, we're joined on the telephone by Marjorie Cohn, Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, author of the book Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. Marjorie Cohn, we always are greatly appreciative of you taking time to join us.
Well, thanks for having me, Mitch. I appreciate that.
Marjorie, what is obstruction of Congress?
Obstruction of Congress is interfering with Congress's constitutional duty to have the power over all impeachments. The Constitution says that the House of Representatives shall have the sole power of impeachment. That means that the president doesn't get to censor what Congress does. And by stonewalling the proceedings in the House during the impeachment inquiry, the president violated, basically, you know, thumbed his nose at the separation of powers, at the Constitution's clear command that the House of Representatives has the sole power of impeachment. So he refused to allow any document, he didn't produce one document, he refused to allow all executive branch employees from testifying, and he said that they would enjoy absolute immunity from civil and criminal liability. Now, absolute immunity is a doctrine that no court has upheld. In fact, recently in the McGahn case, a court struck it down and said that a president is not king, and he doesn't have control over, over everything, over everyone. Now, Trump's lawyers will talk a lot about, when it's their turn to rebut Article 2, they'll talk a lot about executive privilege and how forcing witnesses to testify and documents to be turned over would violate executive privilege, and that's going to hurt future presidents. Actually, Trump has not asserted executive privilege at all. He just says they shouldn't testify, period. Executive privilege is invoked for certain internal executive branch communications and may or may not be sustained by, I guess, the Chief Justice will make that ruling, although 51 senators can overrule him. But the witness is testifying, and the witness is asked a question, and then the defense lawyers for Donald Trump will say, objection, that calls for an answer that's protected by executive privilege, and then there will be a ruling on whether the witness has to answer that. But he hasn't asserted executive privilege. He has just completely stonewalled. And he's also making that same argument, his lawyers, to prevent the Senate from calling witnesses and subpoenaing documents. Now, they've already had pretrial motions where the House managers, the prosecutors, tried to amend the Senate rules that Mitch McConnell had come up with to allow four witnesses to testify, to allow the subpoena of four witnesses, including Mick Mulvaney, acting chief of staff, who actually admitted there was a quid pro quo, a this for that, a dirt for dollars, however you want to say it, and John Bolton, the former national security advisor to Trump, who left on very uncomfortable terms. And Trump has already indicated that he will assert executive privilege to Bolton's testimony. He's very worried about it. He says, Bolton knows all of my thoughts on these issues, and so it's a threat to national security. And he said that Bolton left on less than positive terms, and he's really, really afraid of what Bolton would say. And then the other subpoenas that were tabled by, on a strict party line vote, the Republicans voting to table the issue of witnesses and the issue of production of documents, the subpoenaing of documents from the White House, the Pentagon, the Office of Management and Budget, etc. And by tabling the issue of whether the Senate will call, will hear witnesses or force the administration to turn over these documents, what they're doing is kind of an Alice in Wonderland type of thing, where first the trial, then the evidence. So there's going to be 6 days of opening statements, 3 from the managers. This is today's the 3rd day of their opening statements, 3 from the defense, then 16 hours of the senators questioning, asking questions, and then they may turn to the issue of whether witnesses can be subpoenaed or documents produced. They may or may not. It's not clear whether these, they need a 51 votes, and some senators, kind of moderate senators like Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski and Mitch Romney, have made noises that they may vote to hear witnesses, although I'll believe it when I see it. So that may or may not come to the floor. McConnell wants to rush this through. He wants to get it over with. He wants to have an acquittal in hand that Trump can brag about during his State of the Union address on February 4th. And initially, McConnell wanted each side to present its 24 hours of opening statements in 2 days, which would have made for 12-hour days, which would have made them go from 1 p.m. Eastern to 1 a.m. in the morning. And he finally gave on that. I think some of the moderate Republicans said, wait a minute, this is just too much. Because the senators have to sit in their seats without asking questions. They have to sit silently on pain of imprisonment. They can't have cell phones. Some of them are getting up and walking around and they're restless. But many of these Republicans have never heard the case before. They either didn't pay attention when the House was holding its hearings, or they watch Fox News, which does voiceovers. It shows a little picture of the testimony.
Yeah, I noticed that last night as I was watching it. They weren't actually bringing you the hearing. They just had it. They had a video of it the entire time, but they were talking over it with their regular show. Marjorie, we are almost out of time. They're now doing the prayer at the beginning of the Senate, and then they're going to the trial, and then they're going to do the Pledge of Allegiance. We probably have about 30 seconds. It seems like this case, Article 2 of impeachment, obstruction of Congress, is a pretty easy case to prove.
It is easy unless you buy this absolute immunity theory that Trump is putting forth. And even if you do, and Nadler talked about this last night, even if you do buy the absolute immunity, that witnesses have absolute immunity if they don't obey subpoenas, doesn't mean that he can actually keep them from testifying in the first place.
Very good. Marjorie Cohn, Professor Emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, author of the book Drones and Targeted Killing, Legal, Moral, and Geopolitical Issues. You can read her writings at MarjorieCohn.com. Marjorie Cohn, I thank you.
Thanks a lot, Mitch.
And this is live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump. This is John Roberts.
Are approved to date. Hearing no objections, so ordered. The Sergeant-at-Arms will make the proclamation.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons are commanded to keep silent on pain of imprisonment while the Senate of the United States is sitting in a trial of the articles of impeachment exhibited by the House of Representatives against Donald John Trump, President of the United States.
Sergeant at Arms.
The majority leader is recognized.
And this is Mitch McConnell.
For all of our colleagues, some information about scheduling. Today we'll plan to take short breaks every 2 to 3 hours. And we'll accommodate a 30-minute recess for dinner, assuming it is needed, until the House managers have finished their opening presentation. For scheduling purposes, we've organized tomorrow's session to convene at 10 a.m. and run for several hours as the President's counsel begins their presentation.
Pursuant to the provisions of Senate Resolution 483, the managers for the House of Representatives have 7 hours.
So people who are planning to follow this live tomorrow, the hearing will begin 7 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. rather than the 10 a.m. during the week. That's because there will be no Supreme Court session in which John Roberts has to attend to in
Chief
the
Justice,
morning.
Senators,
this is Adam Schiff, Democratic Council representative and lead impeachment manager.
Good morning, but good afternoon. I just wanted to give a very brief orientation to the argument you'll hear today. We will begin with Jason Crow, who was talking about the conditionality of the military assistance. This is the latter part, although not the end of the argumentation on the application of the Constitution and law as it respects Article 1, the abuse of power. I'll have a presentation after Mr. Crow, and soon thereafter we will conclude the presentation on Article 1. We'll then begin the presentation on Article 2, once again applying the Constitution and law to the facts on the president's obstruction of Congress. We will then have some concluding thoughts and then turn it over to the president's counsel. And that is what you should expect for the day. And with that, I will now yield to Mr. Crow of Colorado.
Jason Crow is a Democrat from Colorado, a top Army officer who has served in both the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, one of the seven Democratic floor managers.
I woke up this morning and walked to my local coffee shop where, unlike my esteemed colleague, Mr. Jeffries from New York, nobody complained to me about Colorado baseball. So I could only conclude that this is only a New York Yankees problem. As Mr. Schiff mentioned, we talked last night about the July 25th call and the multiple officials who had confirmed the intent of the president in withholding the aid. So now I'd like to turn to what happened around the time that the aid was lifted. And we know that the aid was lifted ultimately on September 11th, but it wasn't lifted for any legitimate reason. It was only lifted because President Trump had gotten caught. Now let's go through how we know that. On August 26th, the whistleblower complaint had been sent to the Director of National Intelligence. And public reports indicate that President Trump was told about the complaint by White House counsel Pat Cipollone. On September 5th, though, the scheme became public. An editorial in the Washington Post on that day, for the first time publicly, explicitly linked the military aid hold in the investigations that President Trump wanted. Now, keep in mind that public scrutiny of the president's hold increased exponentially after this became public. And this is where things start moving really fast. A few days later, on September 9th, the House Investigative Committees publicly announced their investigation of president's conduct in Ukraine. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman testified that the National Security Council and others at the White House learned about the investigation when it was announced. And a colleague of his said that it might have the effect of releasing the aid. And on that same day, the House Intelligence Committee learns that the administration had withheld the whistleblower complaint from Congress. The scheme was unraveling. And what happens 2 days later? President Trump released the military aid. He only released it after he got caught. But there's another reason we know the president lifted the aid only because he got caught. Because there's no other explanation. The testimony of all of the witnesses confirms it. Both Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and Ms. Williams testified that they were not provided any reason for lifting the hold. Vindman testified that nothing on the ground had changed in the 2 months of the hold, and Mark Sandy of the OMB also confirmed that. And Ambassador Taylor, too, testified that, quote, "I was not told the reason why the hold had been lifted." Now, let me take a moment to address another defense I expect you will hear, that the aid was released and the investigations were never announced, so therefore, no harm, no foul, right? Well, this defense would be laughable if this issue wasn't so serious. First, I've spoken over the past 3 days about the real consequences of inserting politics into matters of war. Real people, real lives are at stake. Every day, every hour matters. So no, the delay wasn't meaningless. Just ask the Ukrainians sitting in trenches right now. And to this day, they are still waiting on $18 million of the aid that hasn't reached them. Jennifer Williams, who attended the Warsaw meeting with Vice President Pence, described President Zelensky's focus during this time.
And you testified in your deposition that in that conversation, President Zelensky emphasized that the military assistance, the security assistance, was not just important to assist Ukraine in fighting a war against Russia, but that it was also symbolic in nature. What did you understand him to mean by that?
President Zelensky explained that more than, or just equally with the financial and physical value of the assistance, that it was the symbolic nature of that assistance that really was the show of U.S. support for Ukraine and for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity. And I think he was stressing that to the vice president to really underscore the need for the security assistance to be released.
And that if the United States was holding the security assistance, is it also true then that Russia could see that as a sign of weakening U.S. support for Ukraine and take advantage of that?
I believe that's what the President Zelensky was indicating, that any signal or sign that U.S. support was wavering would be construed by Russia as potentially an opportunity for them to strengthen their own hand in Ukraine.
This is an important point, particularly when the president and his attorneys try to argue no harm, no foul. The financial assistance itself was really important to Ukraine, no question about it. But the aid was equally important as a signal to Russia of our support for Ukraine. And regardless of whether the aid was ultimately released, the fact that the hold became public sent a very clear signal to Russia that our support for Ukraine was wavering. And Russia was watching very closely for any sign of weakness. The damage was done. Now, any possible doubt about whether the aid was linked to the investigations has been erased by the president's own chief of staff. Now, we've seen this video before during the trial, but there's a really good reason for this. It's a complete admission on national TV that the military aid was conditioned on Ukraine helping the president's political campaign. Here, once again, is what Mulvaney said.
That he also mentioned to me in the past that the corruption related to the DNC server? Absolutely. No question about that. But that's it. And that's why we held up the money.
And when pressed that he had just confessed to the very quid pro quo that President Trump had been denying, Mulvaney doubled down.
But to be clear, what you just described is a quid pro quo. It is funding will not flow unless the investigation into the Democratic server happened as well.
We do that all the time with foreign policy. If you read the news reports and you believe them, what did McKinney say yesterday? Well, McKinney said yesterday that he was really upset with the political influence in foreign policy. That was one of the reasons he was so upset about this. And I have news for everybody. Get over it. There's going to be political influence in foreign policy. I'm talking to Mr.
Now, remember, at the time he made these statements, Mulvaney was both the head of OMB and the acting chief of staff at the White House. He knew about all of the legal concerns. He also knew about the president's so-called drug deal, as Ambassador Bolton called it. He knew exactly what was going on in the Oval Office and how OMB implemented the president's illegal order to hold the aid. Mulvaney confirmed why the president ordered the hold. It was not to develop further policy to counter Russian aggression. It was not to convince the Ukrainians to implement additional anti-corruption reforms, and it was not to pressure our allies to give more to Ukraine. Now, since we won't have an opportunity to respond to the president's presentation, I'm going to take a minute to respond to some of the arguments that I expect them to make. You will notice, I'm sure, that they will ignore significant portions of the evidence while trying to cherry-pick individual statements here and there to manufacture defenses. But don't be fooled. One defense you may hear is that the aid was held up to allow for a policy review. This is what the administration told the GAO at one point. But the evidence shows the opposite. The evidence shows that the administration didn't conduct a review at any time after the president ordered the hold. Laura Cooper was not aware of any review of the funding conducted by DOD in July August, or September. And similarly, George Kent testified that the State Department did not conduct and was never asked to conduct a review of funding administered by the State Department. In fact, on May 23rd, the anti-corruption review was complete and DOD certified to Congress that Ukraine had complied with all of the conditions and that the remaining half of the aid should be released. This was confirmed by the June 18th press release announcing the release or announcing the funding. And do you remember the fictitious quote-unquote interagency review process? Well, that was made up too. So no review was necessary because it had already been done. Next, the President's counsel keeps saying this was about corruption in Ukraine. President Trump was not concerned with fighting corruption. It's difficult to even say that with a straight face. The President never mentioned corruption on either call with President Zelensky. But let's go through the evidence. As we just discussed, DOD had already completed a review and concluded that Ukraine had, quote, made sufficient progress in meeting defense reform and anti-corruption goals consistent with the National Defense Authorization Act in order to receive the funds. And in fact, Mark Sandy, who was not at that meeting, but who was initially responsible for approving the hold, said he had never heard corruption as a reason for the hold in all of the discussions he had about it. Similar to the anti-corruption argument, there is simply no evidence to support the President's after-the-fact argument that he was concerned about burden sharing. Now, that's other countries also contributing to Ukraine. I imagine the President may cite the emails in June about what other countries provided to Ukraine, the reference to other countries' contributions in the July 25th call, and testimony from Sandy about a request for information about what other European countries give to Ukraine. But there is simply no evidence that ties the concern to his decision to hold the funding. First, let's actually look at the contributions of European countries to Ukraine. There's a slide in front of you. It shows that other European countries have significantly contributed to Ukraine since 2014, and the European Union in total has given far more than the U.S. The EU is the single largest donor to Ukraine, having provided over $16 billion in grants and loans. The President's assertion that other countries did not support Ukraine is meritless. And there are other reasons, too. After DOD and OMB responded to the President's request, presumably with some of the information we just provided you, showing Europe gives a lot to Ukraine, nobody in the Trump administration mentioned burden sharing as a reason for the hold to any of the 17 witnesses that we've been talking about. Sondland, whose actual portfolio is the EU, not Ukraine, testified that he was never asked to speak to the EU or EU member countries about providing more aid to Ukraine. And if President Trump were truly concerned about that, he would have been the perfect guy to handle it because he was our ambassador to the EU. But it never happened. And how could it? Because Sondland himself knew the aid was linked to the investigations, because that's what the President himself had told him. It wasn't until the President's scheme began to unravel, after the White House learned of the whistleblower complaint, and after Politico publicly revealed the existence of the hold, that the issue of burden sharing came up again. If the President's concern were genuinely about burden sharing, he never made any public statements about it, never ordered a review of burden sharing, and never ordered his officials to push Europe to increase their contributions. And then he released the aid without any changes in Europe's contributions. This last point is important. You know the president's purported concern about burden sharing rings hollow because the aid was released after the President got caught, not because the EU or any European country made any new contributions. As Lieutenant Colonel Vindman testified, the facts on the ground had not changed. Finally, you may hear the President's counsel say that Ukraine didn't know about the hold until August 28th, long after the hold was implemented, so therefore they could not have felt pressured. But this makes no sense. First, they found out about it long before August 28th. Multiple witnesses testified that the Ukrainians showed, quote, impressive diplomatic trade craft and learning quickly about the hold. And of course, they would know. The DoD release was announced in June, and U.S. agencies knew about it in July. So it should be no surprise that the first inquiries about the aid were on July 25th, the same day as the call. You see, it doesn't matter if extortion lasts 2 weeks or 2 months. It's still extortion, and Ukraine certainly felt the pressure. Other Ukrainian officials also expressed concerns that the Ukrainian government was being singled out and penalized for some reason. And they were, by President Trump. And you know how else you know they felt the pressure from the hold? Because President Zelensky finally relented and was planning to do the CNN interview. Ultimately, right around the time of President Zelensky's conversation with President Trump, which is the subject of the classified document that I urge all senators to look at, President Zelensky canceled the CNN interview. But the damage was already done. The evidence is clear. The question for you is whether it's okay for the president to withhold taxpayer money, aid for our ally, our friend at war, for a personal political benefit. Whether it's okay for the president to sacrifice our national security for his own election. It's not okay to me. It's certainly not okay with the American people. And it should not be okay to any of you.
Comments from Democratic Representative Jason Crow of Colorado, one of seven impeachment floor managers for the Democrats from the House of Representatives. Next up, we're going to hear from Democratic Representative Hakeem Jeffries of New York. He is the chair of the House Democratic Caucus.
Chief Justice, distinguished members of the Senate,
Hakeem Jeffries,
Council, the American people, once again, we are gathered here not as Democrats or Republicans, not as the left or the right, not as progressives or conservatives, but as Americans, doing our constitutional duty during this moment of presidential accountability. And as House managers, we thank you for your courtesy, your attentiveness, and your hospitality. At the heart of Article 2, obstruction of Congress, is a simple, troubling reality. President Trump tried to cheat. He got caught, and then he worked hard to cover it up. The president tried to cheat, he got caught, and then he worked hard to cover it up. Patrick Henry, one of the nation's great patriots, once said that the liberties of a people never were, nor ever will be secure when the transactions of their rulers may be concealed from them. Let's now address the effort by President Trump and his team to cover up his wrongdoing. By July of 2019, White House officials were aware of serious allegations of misconduct by President Trump regarding Ukraine. But instead of halting the president's corrupt scheme, they worked overtime to conceal it from the American people. As additional evidence of the president's wrongdoing mounted, White House lawyers redoubled their efforts to prevent Congress and the American people from learning of the president's misconduct. At the same time, top administration officials, including Secretary of State Pompeo, Secretary of Defense Esper, and National Security Advisor John Bolton, tried to convince President Trump to lift the hold on the security assistance. They failed. President Trump was determined to carry out his corrupt scheme. The military and security aid was only released on September 11th after the hold became public, after the House launched an investigation, and after Congress learned about the existence of a whistleblower complaint. The $391 million in security aid was only released because President Trump was caught red-handed. The actions of President Trump and high-level White House officials allowed his abuse of power to continue beyond the watchful eye of Congress and, most importantly, the American people. As we have discussed at length, on July 10th, Ambassador Sondland told the Ukrainians and other U.S. officials that he had a deal with Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney to schedule the White House meeting President Zelensky wanted if the new Ukrainian leader committed to the phony investigations that President Trump sought. As you've seen in testimony shown during this trial, following that meeting, National Security Council officials Dr. Fiona Hill and Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman immediately reported this information to John Eisenberg, the legal advisor for the National Security Council and a deputy counsel to the president. According to Dr. Hill, Mr. Eisenberg told her that he was also concerned about that July 10th meeting. On the screen is Dr. Hill's deposition testimony, where she explains Mr. Eisenberg's reaction, saying, I mean, he wasn't aware that Sondland, Ambassador Sondland, was kind of running around doing a lot of these meetings, and independently, we talked about the fact that Ambassador Sondland said he'd been meeting with Giuliani, and he was very concerned about that. And he said that he would follow up on this. Mr. Eisenberg was very concerned about that and said that he would follow up on this. Dr. Hill further testified that Mr. Eisenberg told her that he followed up with his boss, the distinguished White House counsel, Pat Cipollone. However, because the president blocked Mr. Eisenberg from testifying in the House, we do not know what, if anything, he or Mr. Cipollone did in response to this deeply troubling information. What we do know is that President Trump's effort to cheat continued with reckless abandon by failing to put the brakes on the wrongdoing after that July 10th meeting, even after they were notified by concerned national security officials. The White House attorneys allowed it to continue unchecked. Right around the same time that the July 10th meetings at the White House took place, the Office of Management and Budget began executing President Trump's illegal order to withhold all security assistance from Ukraine. On July 12th, Robert Blair, an assistant to the president, communicated the hold to the acting director of the Office of Management and Budget, Russell Vought. On July 18th, an Office of Management and Budget official communicated the hold to other executive branch agencies, including the Department of State and the Department of Defense. And a week later, on July 25th, President Trump had his imperfect telephone call with President Zelensky and directly pressured the Ukrainian leader to commence phony political investigations as part of his effort to cheat and solicit foreign interference in the 2020 election. The July 25th call marked an important turning point. If there was any question among senior White House officials and attorneys about whether President Trump was directly involved in the Ukraine scheme, as opposed to just a rogue operation being led by Rudolph Giuliani or some other underlings, after July 25th, there can be no mistake. The President of the United States was undoubtedly calling the shots. Thereafter, the complicity of White House officials with respect to the cover-up of the President's misconduct intensified. Immediately after the July 25th call, both Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and his direct supervisor, Tim Morrison, reported their concerns about the call to Mr. Eisenberg and his deputy, Michael Ellis. In fact, within an hour after the July 25th call, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman returned again a second time to Mr. Eisenberg and reported his concerns.
I was concerned by the call. What I heard was inappropriate, and I reported my concerns to Mr. Eisenberg. It is improper for the President of the United States to demand a foreign government investigate a U.S. citizen and a political opponent. I was also clear that if Ukraine pursued an investigation, into the 2016 elections, the Bidens and Burisma, it would be interpreted as a partisan play. This would undoubtedly result in Ukraine losing bipartisan support, undermining U.S. national security, and advancing Russia's strategic objectives in the region. I want to emphasize to the committee that when I reported my concerns on July 10th relating to Ambassador Sondland, and then July 25th relating to the President, I did so out of a sense of duty. I privately reported my concerns in official channels to the proper authority in the chain of command. My intent was to raise these concerns because they had significant national security implications for our country. I never thought that I'd be sitting here testifying in front of this committee and the American public about my actions. When I reported my concerns, my only thought was to act properly and to carry out my duty.
Timothy Morrison, the National Security Council's Senior Director for Europe and Russia, also reported the call to Mr. Eisenberg and asked him to review the call, which he feared would be damaging if leaked.
Now, Mr. Morrison, shortly after you heard the July 25th call, you testified that you alerted the NSC legal advisor, John Eisenberg, pretty much right away. Is that right?
Correct.
And you indicated in your opening statement, or at least from your deposition, that you went to Mr. Eisenberg out of concern over the potential political fallout if the call record became public, and not because you thought it was illegal. Is that right?
Correct.
But you would agree, right, that asking a foreign government to investigate a domestic political rival is inappropriate, would you not?
It's not what we recommended the president discuss.
The July 25th call was at least the second time that National Security Council officials had reported concerns about President Trump's pressure campaign to White House lawyers. The second time, who now clearly understood the gravity of the ongoing misconduct. But because the president blocked Mr. Eisenberg from testifying without any justification, the record is silent as to what, if any, actions he or the White House counsel took to address President Trump's brazen misconduct and abuse of power. We do know, however, that instead of trying to halt the scheme, White House lawyers facilitated it by taking affirmative steps to conceal evidence of President Trump's misconduct. For example, after Lieutenant Colonel Vindman and Mr. Morrison reported their concerns related to the July 25th call to the National Security Council lawyers, they tried to bury the call summary. They tried to bury it. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman testified that the National Security Council lawyers believed it was, quote, appropriate to restrict access to the call summary. for the purpose of the leaks and to preserve the integrity of the transcript. According to Lieutenant Colonel Vindman, Mr. Eisenberg gave the go-ahead to restrict access to the call summary. Mr. Morrison testified that he learned in late August, after he raised concerns that the call record might leak and politically damage the president, that the call summary had been placed on a highly classified National Security Council server. The call record was placed on a server that is reserved for America's most sensitive national security secrets and covert operations, not routine calls with foreign leaders. Apparently, Mr. Eisenberg claimed at the time that burying the call transcript on a highly classified server was a mistake.
Now, in a second meeting with Mr. Eisenberg, what did you recommend that he do to prevent the call record from leaking?
I recommended we restrict access to the package.
Had you ever asked the NSC legal advisor to restrict access before?
No.
Did you speak to your supervisor, Dr. Kupperman, before you went to speak to John Eisenberg?
No.
Did you subsequently learn that the call record had been put in a highly classified system?
I did.
And what reason did Mr. Eisenberg give you for why the call record was put in the highly classified system?
It was a mistake.
He said it was just a mistake?
It was an administrative error.
In Mr. Morrison's view, the July 25th call record did not meet the requirements to be placed on a highly classified server. At his deposition, Mr. Morrison testified that the call record was placed on the server by mistake. However, even after this alleged mistake was uncovered, the July 25th call summary was not removed from the classified system because someone was trying to hide it. It was not until the launch of the House impeachment inquiry in late September and after intense public pressure that the rough transcript of the July 25th call was released. Again, because Mr. Eisenberg and Mr. Ellis refused to testify in the House, we do not know exactly how the July 25th call record ended up on this highly classified National Security Council server. What we do know is that Mr. Eisenberg ordered access restricted after multiple officials like Dr. Fiona Hill and Lieutenant Colonel Vindman advised him of the scheme to condition a White House meeting on phony political investigations. This strongly suggests that there was an active attempt to conceal the clear evidence of the president's wrongdoing. Instead of addressing the president's misconduct, Mr. Eisenberg seemingly tried to cover it up. Why did Mr. Eisenberg place the July 25th call summary on a server for highly classified material? Did anyone senior to Mr. Eisenberg direct him to hide the call record? Why did the call record remain on the classified server even after the so-called error was discovered? Who ordered the cover-up of the call record? Who ordered the cover-up of the call record? The American people deserve to know. Following the July 25th call, the president's scheme to pressure Ukraine for political purposes intensified. Apparently unchecked by any effort to stop it from the White House counsel's office. After the July 25th call, Ambassadors Sondland and Volker worked with the president's personal lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani, to procure a public statement from President Zelensky to announce phony investigations into Joe Biden and the CrowdStrike conspiracy theory being peddled by President Trump. At the same time, President Trump continued to withhold the White House meeting and security assistance from Ukraine in a manner that broke the law. As these efforts were ongoing, White House attorneys reportedly received yet another warning sign that the president was abusing his power. According to a published report in the New York Times, the week after the July 25th call, an anonymous whistleblower reported concerns that the president was abusing his office for personal gain. The whistleblower complaint landed in the CIA General Counsel's office. Although the concerns related directly to the president's own misconduct, the CIA's General Counsel, Courtney Elwood, alerted Mr. Eisenberg. Over the next week, Ms. Elwood, Mr. Eisenberg, and their deputies reportedly discussed the whistleblower's concerns, and they determined, as required by law, that the allegations had a reasonable basis. So, by early August, White House lawyers began working along with attorneys at the Department of Justice to cover up the president's wrongdoing. They were determined to prevent Congress and the American people from learning anything about the president's corrupt behavior. Although senior Justice Department officials, including Attorney General Bill Barr, were reportedly made aware of the concerns about corrupt activity, no investigation into President Trump's wrongdoing was even opened by the Department of Justice. As White House and Justice Department lawyers were discussing how to deal with the whistleblower's concerns, on August 12th, another important date, the whistleblower filed a formal complaint with the Inspector General for the intelligence community. In accordance with federal law, on August 26th, the Inspector General transmitted the whistleblower complaint to the Acting Director of National Intelligence, Joseph McGuire, along with the Inspector General's preliminary conclusion that the complaint was both credible and related to a matter of urgent concern. Urgent concern. But instead of transmitting the whistleblower complaint to the House and to this Senate's Distinguished Intelligence Committee, as required by law, the Acting Director of National Intelligence notified the White House.
Well, Director, I'm still trying to understand the chronology. So you first went to the Office of Legal Counsel, and then you went to White House Counsel?
We went, and then to the, repeat that please, sir.
I'm just trying to understand the chronology. You first went to the Office of Legal Counsel, and then you went to the White House Counsel?
No, sir. No, we went to the White House first to determine, to ask the question.
Okay, that's all I wanted to know is chronology. So you went to the White House first. So you went to the subject of the complaint for advice first about whether you should provide the complaint to Congress.
There were issues within this, a couple of things. One, it did appear that it has executive privilege. If it does have executive privilege, it is the White House that determines that. I cannot determine that as the Director of National Intelligence.
Under federal law, the Acting Director of National Intelligence was required to share the whistleblower complaint with Congress. Period. Full stop. If that had occurred, the president's scheme to withhold security assistance and a White House meeting being sought by the new Ukrainian leader to pressure Ukraine for his own personal political gain would have been exposed. To prevent that from happening, the president's lawyers and top-level advisors adopted a two-pronged cover-up strategy. First, block Congress and the American people from learning about the whistleblower complaint. Second, try to convince President Trump to lift the hold on the security assistance before anyone can find out about it and use that evidence against them. As to the first prong, sometime after the acting director of national intelligence told the White House counsel's office about the complaint on August 26th, Mr. Cipollone and Mr. Eisenberg reportedly briefed the president. They likely discussed with President Trump whether they were legally required to give the complaint to Congress. They stated that they were consulting with the Office of Legal Counsel at the Department of Justice. The acting director of National Intelligence testified that he and the inspector general consulted with the Office of Legal Counsel, who opined without any reasonable basis that he did not have to turn over the complaint to Congress. On September 3rd, the day after the statutory deadline for the Director of National Intelligence to provide the complaint to this body and to the House, the Office of Legal Counsel issued a secret opinion concluding that, contrary to the plain language of the statute, the acting director of national intelligence was not required to turn over the complaint. The cover-up was in full swing. The Office of Legal Counsel opined that the whistleblower complaint did not qualify as an urgent concern and therefore did not have to be turned over. What can be more urgent than a sitting president trying to cheat in an American election by soliciting foreign interference? What can be more urgent than that? That's a constitutional crime in progress. But they concluded it wasn't an urgent matter. Acting Director of National Intelligence McGuire testified that the Office of Legal Counsel opinion did not actually prevent him from turning over the complaint to Congress. Instead, based upon his testimony, it is clear that he withheld it on the basis that the complaint might deal with information that he believed could be covered by executive privilege. But President Trump never actually invoked executive privilege. He never actually invoked executive privilege. Nor did he inform Congress that he was doing so with respect to this complaint. Instead, the White House secretly instructed the acting director of national intelligence to withhold the complaint based on the mere possibility that executive privilege could be invoked. By doing so, the White House was able to keep the explosive complaint from Congress and the American public without ever having to disclose the reason why it was withholding this information. But truth crushed to the ground will rise again. There's a toxic mess at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. And I humbly suggest that it's our collective job on behalf of the American people to try to clean it up. President Trump tried to cheat. He got caught. And then he worked hard to cover it up. There have been many great presidents throughout the history of this republic. Great Republican presidents and great Democratic presidents. Perhaps one of the greatest presidents is Abraham Lincoln. He once said that any man can handle adversity, but if you want to test a man's character, give him some power. America is a great nation. We can handle adversity better than any other country in the world. Whenever America has found itself in a tough spot, we always make it to the other side. We were in a tough spot during the Civil War, when America was at risk of tearing itself apart, but we made it to the other side. A tough spot in October of 1929, when the stock market collapsed, plunging us into the Great Depression, but we made it to the other side. We were in a tough spot in December of 1941, when a foreign power struck, plunging us into a great conflict with the evil empire of Nazi Germany, but America made it to the other side. We were in a tough spot in the 1960s dealing with the inherent contradictions of Jim Crow, but we made it to the other side. We were in a tough spot on September 11th, when the towers were struck, and young men and women like Jason Crow were sent to Afghanistan to fight the terrorists there, so we didn't have to fight the terrorists here. And we made it to the other side. America is a great country. We can handle adversity better than any other nation in the world. But what are we going to do about our character? President Trump tried to cheat and solicit foreign interference in an American election. That is an attack on our character. President Trump abused his power and corrupted the highest office in the land. That is an attack on our character. President Trump tried to cover it all up and hide it from the American people and obstruct Congress. That's an extraordinary attack on our character. America is a great nation. We can handle adversity better than any other country in the world. But what are we going to do about our character?
Live coverage of the Senate impeachment trial of President Donald Trump on KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 FM in Fresno, K248BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, and 90.7 FM KPFK in Los Angeles. We just heard from Hakeem Jeffries. He has finished his remarks. We now return back to Democratic Representative Jason Crow.
To lift the hold on military aid and stem the fallout in case it went public. And it did go public. On August 28th, Politico publicly reported that the president was withholding the military aid. And as you've heard, the public disclosure of the president's hold in late August caused deep alarm among Ukrainian officials. It also caused U.S. officials to redouble their efforts once again. At the end of August, Secretary of State Pompeo, Defense Secretary Esper and Ambassador Bolton reportedly tried to convince President Trump to release the aid, but they failed. The president wanted the hold to remain. That prompted Duffy, the political appointee charged with implementing the hold, to send an email on August 30th to the DOD stating, and I quote, "Clear direction from POTUS to hold." Now, this is consistent with Laura Cooper's deposition testimony when she said that they were, quote, hopeful this whole time that Secretary Esper and Secretary Pompeo would be able to meet with the president and just explain to him why this was so important and get the funds released. But instead, the president held firm. And even as the president's own cabinet officials were trying to convince him to lift the hold, White House lawyers were receiving new reports about their president's abuse. On September 1st, Vice President Pence met with President Zelensky in Warsaw, and immediately after, Sondland, had a side conversation with the top Ukrainian presidential aide. Morrison was privy to these conversations, and when he returned from Warsaw, he reported to Eisenberg the details.
What did Ambassador Sondland tell you that he told Mr.